Welcome to Digging the Dharma, where we dig into the Buddhist Dharma and explore ways to bring these 2,500-year-old teachings into our lives. I'm Doug Smith of Doug's Dharma on YouTube and the online Dharma Institute.
And I'm John Aaron, teacher at New York Insight Meditation Center and mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher and teacher trainer and founder of Space to Meditate. Greetings, Doug. Long time.
Great to see you again, John, as always.
We've both been in different parts of the world. We had a lovely trip to Seattle.
Nice.
Northwest for a few days, and then a layover in Chicago on my way back to New York. And now I'm here and going to Chicago later next month. So
yeah, you're getting ready to become a Chicagoan.
I guess by the time this airs, it'll be later this month.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, no, that's not true. This will air on the 31st. And,
probably, yeah.
Whatever. You know, time is a fabrication anyway. So
tell that to the tax and authorities.
Yeah, right. A good point. Well, it might work.
Yeah, it might work. I don't think so.
And you had a trip to Spain, to the Basque Country.
To several places in Spain, including Basque Country. My wife is from North Spain, so we always enjoy it there. And I picked up a very fun cold and bronchitis, which I am now getting over. So if I start coughing uncontrollably, you'll know the reason. But
okay.
I think I'm pretty
Hopefully
much
that
over
won't
it.
Happen.
Yeah, I'm pretty much over it by now.
Great. So we thought we'd touch on some, I don't know if I'd call it fragile territory, but, you know.
Controversial, maybe. A little bit controversial.
Yeah.
Depending on your background.
Yeah, I mean, it's just this thing we call, that's called Buddha nature, this term that's used often and not in the earlier traditions, although as those traditions are sort of melded into various, you know, in this country, things morph into things all the time, as they do elsewhere. And it's like, where is that line, if there is a line, and who's... So, you know, is Buddha nature something that we talk about in the insight community? Depends on who you ask.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, in the later traditions, it's very much a part of those traditions. And but, you know, when you hear the term, what does it mean? And is it something that we're striving for, or is it part of our... Yeah, I mean, I use it probably... I don't use it that much, but I do use it. I mean, it does come up and in various contexts, and I hear it certain ways, and people no doubt receive it in certain ways. But I'm curious, just historically, and I know it's not your area of expertise at all, but obviously you're looking into it. You know what? You know, where does it arise? Where is that term first coming in?
Yeah, I mean, the first real texts about Buddha nature are really in the sort of the first couple centuries of the Common Era. But it arose, I mean, you can say that there are seeds of it in the early texts. I mean, in other words, it doesn't come from nowhere.
Right.
So in the early texts, you have the concept of the luminous mind that is, affected by transient faults, you know.
Right.
And that idea in the early texts of the luminous mind, at least scholars tend to believe it was really more about samadhi, deep states of samadhi, like jhana and so on, deep states of meditative absorption that made the mind more pliable and able to achieve enlightenment. However, the expression about the luminous mind sort of caught a spark in some people. And there's also, you know, ideas in the early texts where the Buddha says, when you see me, you see the Dharma.
Hmm.
That, you know, he talks at one point to an elderly, or I should say a very ill monastic who's on his deathbed, and the monastic is sorry that he has not seen the Buddha in person and heard him talk recently or very much. And the Buddha basically dismisses that and says, you know, you don't need to see me. I'm just this body of mine. This is not important. What's important is the Dharma. And when you see the Dharma, you see me. And so, I think these ideas sort of came together. I mean, the Buddha actually does use the term, the Buddha body, basically, in that discussion. And these ideas and others similar, but not many. I mean, there's a handful of ideas in the early texts that sort of came together in this notion that the Buddha somehow survived his death in a way, and exists sort of in a deified manner, sort of in all things. And that essence of what the Buddha was is pure, is essentially pure. It's this luminous mind, this pure mind, this Buddha mind that exists in all beings and that is what is responsible for our ability to become not only enlightened, which was the early idea, but to become Buddhas, which becomes the right. Mahayana ideal.
Right.
And so this whole idea sort of becomes, in a certain sense, a complete revolution in the Dharma, because it's very different from the Dharma that you find in the early texts, really. I mean, where in the early texts, there isn't any essence to who you are. There's no essential mind. There's no essential self. There's no essential being. The only thing that you see when you look, when you experience, is non-self. In the later tradition, this idea of Buddha nature goes, as you know, in many different directions. Some directions really reified as a real thing, as a real essence, as some permanent thing, a sort of a non-dual consciousness that is the ground of what exists. And in other interpretations, for example, in the Madhyamaka interpretation we find in Tibet, and parts of Tibet anyway, it's reinterpreted where this Buddha nature is just an expression of shunyata, or emptiness, mm-hmm. or non-self.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, in a sense, the Buddha nature is just what was being discussed in early Buddhism. It's this non-self. It's just sort of a different way of talking about this material.
Right.
And all of these different strands exist in later Buddhism. And I think sometimes when you hear scholars or practitioners, they may say, oh, well, one is the right one. You know, I mean, for instance, if you go to certain people in Tibet, I mean, one of my, you know, teachers of Tibet would have said, you know, the Prasangika Madhyamaka interpretation is the correct one. You know, Buddha right, nature just is emptiness.
Yes.
You know, other people may make a different, you know, but in any event, historically, one of the interesting things is that Buddhism really is full of disagreements between people about what terms mean.
Just like every other
religion. Just no. like every other, you know. But anyway, yeah. So it's controversial. I say it's controversial yeah. in the sense that there are different interpretations right. of it. And these different interpretations may be palatable to some of us and not palatable to others of us. So, yeah, that's the sort of...
Yeah, and I know what little I know of the Vasubandhu teachings on the three natures. There's the imagined nature, there's the dependent nature, and there's the fully realized nature. And so the fully realized nature would be, in a sense, I would imagine Buddha nature in that, in the same way of non-self, in the same way of emptiness. And I mean, it's fascinating to me. And then, you know, the term is kind of used all the time. There's a whole, actually, a few months ago, the last quarter of, I think it was the last quarter or the quarter before of the Buddha Dharma magazine, was all about Buddha nature and different interpretations of it from various traditions. I believe they were all Mahayana traditions, but
yeah, it's a Mahayana.
And Tibetan traditions. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a Mahayana. I mean, you find echoes of it in the Theravada, but it's basically a Mahayana teaching.
And you know, but and yet, you know, I've been on you know, with various Theravada teachers or teachers, you know, grounded in those traditions who have used that term. And I know I've used it occasionally, you know, so when I hear it when I maybe use it, it is that mind which is free of all kleshas. It's just free, and it may only be momentary, you know, but there in that moment where it's experienced, nothing is needed. You know, it's just that.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's a moment of freedom. And of course, and then it's also you know, how we are in the world, you know, and we know when we are in the world in a way that is constricted by these kleshas, by these obstructions, by, you know, wanting and desire and not wanting and, you know, all of that. When we are in the world that way, we are by no means free, and we know what that feels like. if we are aware of it, right? But in those moments where, in fact, oh, it's just this, this kind of, what's the term that's often used, this suchness, right?
Mm-hmm. Tata, you know, yeah.
Yeah, which I love that word. Mm-hmm. Both tata and suchness. I mean, there's something, it's just, you know, there's, and that is, those are moments of pure being in a sense, of just complete presence with what's in front of me, you know, and then something gets in the way and it's gone. And so these moments of freedom, these moments of true freedom, we need to recognize them when they arrive. It's important to know what that feels like. And in a sense, know that Buddha nature and know what gets in the way, because that's really what our practice is, if we think about it that way. So, you know, if the mind is naturally luminous or bright, that's the other word that's often used, right? And if that's the case, what is keeping it from being so? And in a way, that's what meditation is about. It's like seeing clearly through all of this. At times, you know, there may be a momentary breakthrough. It's like, oh. And there's a knowing of that. And then, of course, desire kicks in, you know, and we try to have it more. And it doesn't come back, you know. I think it can be a useful term in the sense that, I mean, for me at least, you know, it's, well, A, it's like a reminder of the Buddha's own freedom, you know, and a reminder that it's possible to have that luminous mind and to sustain it over a period, and recognizing when it's just the opposite, right? And so it's so interesting to me that there's a controversy, so to speak. I mean, in scholarly circles anyway, but also in certainly in other, I don't know. I just find it interesting that people can have we can get wrapped up in the words and forget the experience. I guess that's what I'm.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it depends how you, I guess, interpret the words. If I think for the controversy, I think with, as I understand it anyway, with some is just that if you say that there's a, you know, an original mind, which is often what's said in Zen and so on, there's an original mind, this kind of originally pure mind, that seems to imply a kind of a permanent essence to who we really are. And the Buddha was at great pains to deny such a thing.
Right. In other words, if we reify it as
Exactly. Yeah. And it does, at least from the rhetoric of Buddha nature, it sounds as though it's trying to reify this mind. And to be perfectly fair, in some texts, it really does read as though it's being reified. In other texts, it does not. So, you know, and you have to sort of decide how you want to go with this. You know, and there are, I'm sure, I mean, I've certainly encountered Buddhists, at least parent Buddhists, who really do think it's a reified. And certainly in the Yogacara tradition, as I understand it, there is at least one interpretation of that tradition in which it really is being reified, that mind, that pure non-dual consciousness is, you know, is this sort of essence of what is, and that in a real sense. And in some interpretations of this Yogacara material, which is later, you know, Mahayana material, it was constructed, at least some of it, in opposition to the Madhyamaka, because some Yogacarans believed that the Madhyamaka had gone too far, that they were becoming nihilist, and that they were denying too much, that shunyata, that emptiness, was becoming a kind of nihilism, and that the true picture was one in which consciousness was at the base of all things, that there was this kind of original mind, this kind of original non-dual consciousness, and that underlay all things and from which all arose. Now, again, this is part of the controversy because there's disagreements. The Madhyamaka disagree with that.
Right.
And when I was learning about the Madhyamaka when I was in graduate school, our Tibetan professor was going through these arguments back and forth and talking about how the Yogacharans were saying this and the Prasangikas had this response and, you know, and certainly within the Tibetan tradition, at least the Tibetan tradition from Tibet, they teach it that way, that,
right.
you know, that you, you know, you begin with the early Buddhist sort of, you know, stuff, and then you move on to the Yogacara and you learn about that. And then you move on to the Madhyamaka and learn why the Yogacara is wrong. You know, I mean, it's this yeah. kind of progression. And, you know, as far as, you know, sort of sophisticated philosophy in Buddhism goes, that's about as sophisticated as you get. I mean, it's very, very recondite, very scholarly, very...
Fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I think here we're getting into some of why it's controversial, I think.
Yeah.
And it all sort of depends on how you hold it. And all these things, you know, is a question of views. And do you hold, you know, do you cling to these views or do you... hold them with an open hand and you know, consider them just sort of ways that one can approach one's experience.
And it's fascinating that you can actually reify something that you can't hold on to.
Yeah. Well, anything that you have a concept yeah. of, you can reify for
right.
sure.
And so it's more, this is why I keep saying, it's like, well, what's the actual experience of this?
Mm.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, even experiences themselves can be reified because you put a name to an experience, you know.
Yeah.
And
fair enough. Fair
you know,
enough.
I mean, it's sort of like, you know, people talk about phenomenology. You know, okay, here's an here's my philosophy is a phenomenological philosophy where all we have are experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But then you reify the experiences, you know, you say this experience of red in a particular color in a particular time and place. Well, that's just reifying it, you know. I mean,
right. The moment, of course, the moment you name it.
Yeah, the moment it becomes a concept.
And yet, but yeah. that's the fun thing, right? It's like, yeah. okay, all right, so there's red. What is the actual experience of red? Red is, you know, just a word.
Mm-hmm.
What is the experience of it? How is it felt in this body-mind complex, you know?
Right.
And what about people who are colorblind?
Yeah.
You know, what are they experiencing in red?
Yeah.
And, you know,
well, they don't, presumably, or at least depends on colorblind.
So I'm red blind, colorblind.
Red green?
Red green, colorblind. It runs in our mm-hmm. family, in the men in our family, which is how it works genetically, right? So, but I can see red, but it's only when the red is next to a green thing that I have a hard time seeing the red.
Distinguishing them.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a cardinal in a tree, I will have a hard time finding that cardinal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most obvious, the evident. Experience of that.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I'm having an experience. You know?
Right. But it's probably qualitatively different from somebody who isn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's like birds who have four different kinds of cones in their eyes and so therefore see colors
of course. Yeah.
that we can't see, that we right. can't even contemplate because yeah. we don't have that apparatus.
Right.
There's a very famous philosophy essay by Thomas Nagel called What It's Like to Be a Bat. Mm. Very, very famous in the question of consciousness in philosophy. And the point that he makes is that a bat has a completely different apparatus for
sure.
interpreting the world, which is this yeah. echolocation.
Right.
And do we have any real concept of what it's like to be an echolocator in the way that a bat is? And his point is, I mean, we don't know. I mean, it's hard to, you know, probably we don't know what it's like. But of course, you can't know that we don't know. I mean, maybe their experience is like our seeing, but it just comes through echolocation.
Right.
Who knows? But it is, it's one of these kinds of unanswerable conundrums about consciousness.
Yeah. And so the moment we put the name Buddha nature onto something, in a sense, and this really gets a little deeper than that because it's we are talking about name, right, and language,
mm-hmm.
right, and
concepts,
and so,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
concepts, yeah,
yeah, and because that's the way the human brain anyway works, you know, the question is when does the concept get in the way of the experience?
Mm-hmm.
So if we have an idea about what Buddha nature is. Do we start striving for that idea of what we think it is? And, you know, or is it just a matter of allowing experience to arise through practice And in those moments where there is that sense of unification of mind, samadhi, let it just happen. Because, of course, the moment, at least in my experience, the moment it's named, it becomes something else, in a sense. And so it's really interesting in the teaching realm, especially with newer people, when they try to explain their experience. And we realize how much words can get in the way, or not necessarily get in the way, but how certain things just don't require words.
Mm.
And yet we are so used to being in concepts
mm-hmm.
that we can.
Yeah, they're helpful. Yeah. I mean, the reason we get lost in them is that in the main, they're helpful. I mean, they help us to, they're like maps, you know, they help us to get around in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I get comments all the time in my videos about, you know, people saying like, I had this experience, is this a jhana experience kind of thing? And I just, you know, there's no way for me to answer that question,
right.
Of course.
yeah.
But the point is that they're asking it, you know, in other words,
yeah.
they see this concept of jhana that is expressed in the early texts. It's given a relatively good conceptual rundown of what it is and how to tell whether something's jhana, more or less. And so they hear these things, and mm-hmm. you know, the problem is that they're vague enough that, you know, it's hard to know. And and of course, scholars have, you know, debate about this and get angry with each other about, you know, one person saying one thing is this,
right.
and one person saying no, it's not, that doesn't qualify, and you know. And this is the thing, is that, you know, you have an experience and you want to fit it into something to know what it is. You know, you want to say, okay, am I doing the right thing? Or am I going on the right path to, you know, again, a map, you know, am I going on
right.
the right road to the destination of enlightenment? Or am I off on some, you know, backwater, you know? And so they're using the concepts and you understand that. But then, of course, as you say, you get attached to the concepts, you begin to think that they are more than they, you know, they carry more than they really do,
yeah.
and they can be confusing, and frankly, they can be misleading sometimes. So you have to be
Indeed.
Aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, because as we're talking about Buddha nature, the other concept that comes to mind is pure land, you know.
Yeah.
In the Chan tradition and others, and it's like, what is that? Is that Buddha nature? Is that, you know, or, you know, so how do we hold that? You know, it can be an image in the mind, you know, that we rest in. So sometimes it can be very helpful. Other times it can be really confusing. So I guess one thing that comes to my mind in terms of just practice is taking it all lightly.
Mm.
Right. I mean, these are names. They are ideas of a particular way of being. You know, can we just be with our experience and recognize the difference between an experience which is one of freedom and an experience which isn't?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then look at sort of how the experience of freedom arose and what, like, stopped it, right? And so, you know, that just starting from that place, you know, seeing the obstacles that arise, seeing the hindrances and the kleshas and, you know, all of the things that get in our way, mm-hmm. clearly, and then, you know, directly experience the impermanent nature of these,
mm-hmm.
and then also wondering, well, okay, so is Buddha nature also impermanent?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if it is, then what's after that, right? So it's like a matter of holding everything somewhat lightly.
Yeah. Well, certainly I would say our experience of Buddha nature, insofar as we experience it, would be temporary.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it itself is temporary, that's one of these kinds of questions
right.
about whether we reify it or not.
Right.
Certainly if we're the sort of person who wants to reify it, we'll say it's not temporary. We'll say it's permanent. It's an essence that underlies all all things. I mean, I think one of the reasons, at least to me, it looks like historically the idea of Buddha nature arose is because with the rise of the Mahayana, the goal becomes very, very exalted, becoming a Buddha. Mm-hmm. And it looks like something that is impossibly far away and impossibly difficult to achieve. And so this concept of Buddha nature, to me at least, you know, this is my speculation,
right,
is that it became very useful because all of a sudden the goal becomes much closer. Yeah. Okay, it's not this impossible thing that's mm-hmm. that's a million miles away that we'll never achieve, but it's actually something that's real within us right now.
Yeah, and I think that's really valuable.
Yeah, and it's a reframing in a sense of the path and of the you know, and it makes it more achievable. It makes it more graspable. It makes it, you know, we can it invites us to relax a bit because then the task is more one of, as we would say, non-effort, right? And as they say in Zen, you know, of simply realizing what's already here, rather than the impossible task of somehow making enough effort to achieve this impossible Buddhahood. To me, it has that kind of history. I don't know.
There's some logic that obviously it makes sense. On the other hand, there are also in the early teachings, you know, all these stories of people who were like immediately enlightened. You know,
but they didn't become Buddhas. I mean, in the early teachings,
right,
the idea of Buddha, being a Buddha was just not there. So
So being Buddha, right? How do we be Buddha? Mm. In other words, it's like, well, that has a lot to do with our ethics and and the way we live our lives, you know, or being a Buddha, not being, you know, so there's so many aspects to it, but it is interesting. And it's funny because our conversation has evolved in a way from talking about a specific thing, Buddha, a specific term, Buddha nature, to just the way we name things and things get reified along the way. And is that helpful or not? And when is it helpful versus when is it not helpful? And there's no right or wrong answer here because I think it's a very individual thing. And, you know, it can be debated, I suppose, but that's just another form of holding to views in a sense, you know? Mm-hmm. So, fascinating to be continued.
Yeah. Seems like a cup of coffee would be great right now.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, right. Coffee. Does coffee have Buddha nature or does coffee contribute to Buddha nature? I think
it contributes
probably
to awakeness.
Yeah, that's true. So, we could always use coffee. And that's one of the ways you can support this podcast, as many of you know, and many of you do. So we thank those who have, you know, bought us a cup of coffee or two or three or four or five or more.
Or become members. And that's wonderful.
And also thank you for leaving comments occasionally. I got a comment the other day which corrected me, and I appreciated that. As I told the person who wrote, who I happen to know, I said, this is a spontaneous podcast. We don't have time for fact checking.
Nope. Unfortunately, no.
Gets us into trouble occasionally, as I'm sure this might. So,
if you have corrections, please do let us know. Always happy to know.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
So until next time. Keep digging the Dharma.
Good to talk with you, John.
We'll see you again soon. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on your podcast directory. And please check us out at diggingthedharma.com, where you can leave a comment, buy us a coffee, and even become a member. You can find out more about me, John Aaron, at johnaaron.net, and Doug at dougsdharma.com.